Welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast still annoyed about Jon Pertwee's complete inability to correctly pronounce the name Metebolus 3. I'm Nathan.
I'm Corey.
I'm Pete.
And I'm Si.
Well, nothing's more terrifying than love, and this week we've got it in spades. Alec loves Emma, Clara and the Doctor need one another, and the Crooked Man wants to do unspeakable things to the Crooked Lady immediately after this week's credits roll. So the only question left to answer is, do we love this season's Haunted House episode, Hyde? So, can someone answer this question for me? Why is it called Hyde?
That is the bigger question than Doctor Who, which this season goes on and on about. Because you can't run? Because you've got a thick one? I don't know.
So firstly, is it a verb or is it the noun meaning the skin of an animal? I guess that's probably it. But there's no one to hide from because it turns out everyone's lovely.
Maybe you can't hide from love. There we go.
Oh, you old romantic Pete.
Do you know, I actually think you're pretty close to the mark, Pete. I think this is about people who are hiding from their feelings and hiding from themselves, I think. I mean, Alec, I think, is hiding from himself and his past and what happened during the war. So I think that's where, for me, the title rests.
I think there's that moment too where Emma very, very nearly gets Alec to admit that he has feelings for her or something. Like, there's that bit where she moves her hand towards him, and then when he doesn't react, she has to kind of withdraw it in this embarrassed way, and we're all sort of super awkward for a moment. Maybe that's it. Maybe it is about hiding your feelings. It's odd. There is something going on here, I think, but I just am not sure how clear it is. It seems to me that you've got a few couples. You have Alec and Emma. You have the Doctor and Clara, who have sort of secrets from each other. And you have the strange two aliens that we discover were in love all along. But I'm not sure that we go anywhere with it. It does seem to be kind of resonant. It does tie the whole thing together a bit, but I don't know whether it says anything in particular.
Is the story saying that there's a parallel between Emma and Alec and the Doctor and Clara? And if that is the case, I'm not sure it quite works, I think. There's just the slightest hint when Emma is talking to Clara about the Doctor that Clara might have some feelings for the Doctor or some interest in the Doctor, but it's not taken any further.
Yeah, it's teasing us with that, I think.
She warns her off. She says he's got mice in his heart, in what I thought was actually quite good. It gave me Unquiet Dead vibes for a second with Gwen and, you know, the Doctor and the big bad wolf and stuff.
And there's a twist within, I like the twist within the twist, is a twist the right word, towards the end where, just a development, not a twist, someone pointed out on Twitter the other day that people always say twist when they actually mean development, and now I'm paranoid, where it is revealed that she doesn't answer, so the Doctor's like, actually, I've come here to find out all about Clara, and then our empath friend pretty much lies to him, and because she doesn't trust him, she doesn't think he's trustworthy, so she just says Clara's just an ordinary girl, which either she's a rubbish empath and is telling the truth, or she's a good empath and is lying.
Isn't she telling the truth?
I guess.
I thought she came across like she was telling the truth there, that actually there isn't anything mysterious or unusual about Clara. It's sort of the destiny that is different. So, but Clara herself is just an ordinary person, although she's not necessarily written as anyone who's at all ordinary in any way whatsoever, particularly in this episode, but maybe we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
I tend to agree that that Emma is telling the truth, that I actually don't think that, as far as Clara's concerned, she's anything but an ordinary young woman. So, yes, we find out the truth of that later on in the season, of course.
It's the Moffat thing of hiding the solution to the mystery in plain sight. It turns out that the mystery was what it always had to be. Missy was always going to be the master. And here we get the solution to the problem that the Doctor is trying to solve in this episode, that there's nothing extraordinary about Clara. She's clever, she's brave, but she isn't anything else. And the Doctor doesn't believe her because he's had the experience of seeing her die at Christmas and all of that sort of thing. But as far as Clara herself is concerned, in fact, this is this her first episode? Is this Jenna's first episode?
Yes, it
was. That's Clara 3, yes.
Yeah. Like before even the snowmen, right?
Not, yes, it is.
Not Asylum of Daleks, obviously, but before the snowmen.
Yep.
And I think she is really generic here. I think there's we said last week, there's a kind of Sarah Jane-ness to her performance where it's just the plucky young girl who is mostly defined by the actor's performance, and she doesn't really have anything by way of backstory here at all.
Yeah, I've got her down as like just at this point, and I'm casting my mind back to watching it at this point, I was getting frustrated that she was just this perfectly companion-shaped thing that I didn't have a connection to. And I was enjoying the mystery at the same time as thinking, I don't know how they're going to retcon her into being a believable real person, having started out with her being not that. And for me, they never really did. It never quite. That's why Clara never landed with me, I think. This is looking back from now. Because at the time, it was like she's going through all the motions of being a perfect companion, but it's not built on anything. And you can explore that. But then it's like a retcon when it gets put in, and maybe she's got grandparents, maybe she's posh, maybe she's from Blackpool, because that doesn't matter in terms of what Clara is there to be. There's an emotional cost to that, I guess, in terms of investment in the character.
I must confess, I'm a really lazy Doctor Who fan, and I just wanted her to be a companion. I just wanted to be a companion without this sort of crazy mystery that never really, for me, is satisfying. I just wanted her to be a companion. I just wanted her to be Sarah Jane Smith. not literally Sarah Jane Smith, obviously, but to function in that way so we could just get on with the stories. That's how I felt about it.
I think that we have something about the way that Moffat approaches companions, which is different from the way that Russell approaches them, which is different from the way the classic series did. And what happened with Russell was that they were kind of well-rounded TV people. So they weren't really the sort of person that you would actually meet, but they were the sort of person that you would see on TV in other shows. So it was easy to know how they would react, and you could do fun things with them because they were sort of very clearly defined. And then Moffat wants to do something a bit more high concept with his first companion. And so he does that with Amy and really kind of binds the whole Doctor's personality up with Amy. And then suddenly Amy's gone. I think the Doctor's at a bit of a loose end. And so you've got what is essentially a classic series companion comes in who's just a person who, you know, is plucky and faces the monsters and helps and wanders off, or doesn't wander off last week, actually. And that's really all we have. But the Doctor thinks it's a weird timey-wimey companion that he's got. He thinks he's got a Moffat-style companion, but in reality all he's got is just a normal classic series companion. And I think it's telling that Moffat then dumps that whole idea completely for Bill and she's just a person.
Yeah, exactly. It's really odd, I find, because she's written very generically, but she's also written really oddly at times. Like the moment where she says, "I'm not happy," it's like she's never felt anything at all other than happiness in her life. And she's read about feelings, and suddenly she's got this really strange feeling for the first time ever. Like, oh, what is this? I don't understand this. And then you've got the cup of tea moment, which is very definitely a Sarah Jane Smith callback, where no alcohol or cup of tea is going to solve everything. So it's,
she could murder one.
Exactly. You know, and it's just that trying to make her ordinary, but also just it doesn't quite work because the writing is just all over the place for her.
You're dead right. There's moments where they feel like there's a Steed and Mrs. Peel vibe to it, sort of junior. And then it's like, so are they flirting? And that plays it nicely. There's the bit at the end where he puts his arm around her and then suddenly pulls away. But it's like also, will they, won't they, has been done a lot in Doctor Who by this point. And I'm quite happy for it to just be they won't and just get on with the stories, but they work with it and they're trying to. I read somewhere that the original script they toned the way it was originally written. They said that Clara seemed too bitchy, and so they toned that down to make her less so. Neil Cross himself said that he'd toned that down because he'd only based it on her appearance in Asylum, where she's much more sort of prickly, I guess, or you know, quippy.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, she just functions like an ordinary companion, doesn't she, in the stories?
And she knows she's a companion, doesn't she?
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing. Knowing performance, and I think that's what sort of almost alienates you from her, because it's like she knows almost that she's in a TV show and they're visiting a haunted house and all the tropes are going to be there. We've got a thundery, rainy evening for a start, right from the beginning, right through to the morning where the sun comes back out, and it's exactly what you'd expect. And she is performing in exactly the way you'd expect. And she knows she's performing in exactly the way. I don't know whether that's from Jenna Coleman or from the script, but it doesn't always come across as very likable.
I think it's the script. I mean, some of the dialogue she's saddled with, it's, yeah, you can see very quickly they work out that's not going to work for the rest of the season if we keep giving her words like that. I mean, I did write one down, if you'll indulge me, where she says, whiskey is the 11th most disgusting thing ever invented. I mean, who says that? Not being a whiskey drinker, I don't know, but I'll take her word on it. That's for sure.
Yeah, and it's funny because you can see it's a note. It was made to think she's the sort of person who has lists of things like that. That would be a quirk. That would be an interesting quirk, and it's just forgotten. It's a glimpse of a real odd person that which would be interesting, except it nothing hangs on
no.
it. And she hates Carlisle. And the Carlisle joke. Shall we?
Oh yes, poor Mark McManus, friend of the podcast, who lives in Carlisle. I felt for him there.
that's a bit desperate. That line. That's a let's just insert place name here because we want a punchline for what's the opposite of bliss.
I had literally no idea what that could possibly mean. And
yeah, I remember loads of online debate about it. Does everyone in the UK hate Carlisle? Like, no, not really. It's quite near Blackpool, and she's from Blackpool, so I guess they were going for a local rivalry. If not that near, an hour and a half away, but it's maybe they were going for a regional rivalry thing, like they do with Dan from Liverpool slagging off Manchester.
Well, I just remember that joke work. Being done much better with a Leeds stamp, the big Leeds stamp, you know. Look, I mean, Moffat wants to write sitcom characters because he writes comedy dialogue and he wants characters to be with. And so he does throw jokes in, and he will sometimes let character slide for the sake of a joke. And I don't know that that's always a bad instinct to give into. Sometimes I think the line is sort of worth it. But, you know, this is Neil Cross's first script for the show, and he is asked to do Rings of Ackerton on the strength of this, I think. Obviously, they haven't shot that yet. And I don't know that either of his scripts is particularly successful, despite the fact that he is a very successful and highly regarded TV writer. Is that fair?
I think that's fair because, I mean, I think I've watched it four times, and the closer you look, the more the shortcomings in the dialogue and the writing are revealed. I mean, one of the strengths of the episode is that it's a chamber piece and that this small ensemble cast, the actors, it's the casting and the way it's directed that really lift it up from perhaps possibly a mediocre script, I think. I mean, the actors are just doing a fantastic job and they all come together brilliantly in it. And the way it's been shot and edited, the way it's lit, particularly both in the house but also in the Pocket Universe forest, I just think that's what really makes this episode a success.
Yeah, I think Doug Gray Scott and Jessica Rain are doing a lot of heavy lifting to bring something to their characters that aren't there on the page. And they are doing a lot of work sort of in their body language, particularly when they're in the scenes together. And they're playing it very close and you can see the tension in it that isn't necessarily there in the script. I think they're doing great work there.
Yeah, and Jessica Rain is on my list of future Doctors and was in this episode. I did kind of end up wishing that she was the companion. She just has that. She's got an edge to her, and obviously her Verity Lambert is a spectacular creation a few years after this. Hyde and Rings are my favorite. This is my favorite episode of this season, and Rings is my least favorite. I can't make a complete even judgment on the scripting in that sense because they pressed different buttons in different ways. But this definitely, I think this is my favorite Next Time trailer of the season. I'll tell you that. At the end of Cold War, when this, like, we're in a haunted house next week, there's wood paneling, there's candles, it's got a sapphire and steel vibe. I think I'd just done a sapphire and steel rewatch, and that got me really stoked for this episode, and it didn't blow me away entirely on landing, but it's still because we hadn't had a proper haunted house for a while. Is this New Who's first haunted house? I'm forgetting something massive, aren't I?
No, we had one last year, didn't we? Is the council estate in Night Terrors a haunted house? And certainly the haunted house, the Doll's House, is a haunted house.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've erased that from my memory, Nathan. I don't know what you're talking about.
You were on that one.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm thinking that also the children's home in Day of the Moon as well, with the thunder and
So this is our first sort of retro straight down the line. It's literally an old, big old haunted house in the countryside one for a long time, and it's nice to have them running with that. The lightning sound effect and lighting effect seemed a bit, was it like being deliberately cheesy? I'm not sure it is the same one off that. There was a sound effects record LP from the BBC, Real Death and Horror Sound Effects. And I used it in school plays when I was a teenager. And it was still, and I recognized that lightning bolt and that wolf howl. It is not that lightning bolt in this one, but it is right through any BBC thing up to the 90s. It's the same wolf howl and the same clap of thunder that was on this record that came out in the 60s. It's amazing.
The standard issue BBC sound effects record that they've gone to for the
exactly. Yeah, yeah. Totally. But no, but with this one they have, maybe because we're in HD now, but it did look, we don't see a lightning bolt going across the sky. We just see the outside of the house with a light flashing on it, which is a bit, because it's gone a bit more with that, but I'm loving the vibe. I'm loving the vibe.
I get real Image of the Fendahl vibes from it. And one of the things that I enjoyed watching it this time was seeing something that you could easily imagine them doing in the 70s on Doctor Who, but with, you know, decent lighting and a, you know, expanded budget and things like that. And I think it's deliberately set in 1976 for that reason. And it also has the kind of tension-killing trip to the TARDIS in episode 3, in both stories. And, like, I have to say that I don't object that much to that sequence, but it is odd. We complained with Curse of the Black Spot, among other things, that the Doctor and Captain Avery just head off to the TARDIS to do some exposition and kind of low-level character work when we're expecting piratry to be going on. And I do think it's a kind of a shame that we lose the Haunted House for just, you know, appearing over and over and again in the same place for some reason. It is odd.
Well, I can see why they put that into the episode. I think because there's something really fundamental missing in the haunted house sequences, and that's the fact that the doctor doesn't go and check out a well-stocked larder with cheese and wine.
And there isn't an old lady. We need a witchy old lady. That's the one. Maybe she's in charge of stocking the larder with the wine. Yeah.
Well, in fact, that we don't have a ghost. Like, it is a haunted house where there's no ghost, and the ghost is, in fact, from the future rather than from the past, and is someone who's experiencing distress but hasn't actually died. So I think that the episode sort of leans into the haunted house tropes and kind of images as much as possible in order to sell that surprise, that contrast. Turns out it's not a ghost after all. So it has to be super ghosty with, you know, writing on the wall and cold spots and a mysterious hand and all of that sort of thing.
How did she do the help me?
Yes.
How did she actually
do that? It doesn't matter.
It just
this
did.
This is not the first time that that sort of thing has happened on Doctor Who. We're just rolling with it.
Yeah. Ghost reasons.
Ghost reasons.
Yes, ghost reasons. Yes.
Yeah, they're even more powerful than space reasons, although usually explained by space reasons very hastily at the end of episode 4.
Shall we talk about Interstellar, the Christopher Nolan film?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Go for it.
Because I think this is where this episode falls down, and that's the idea that time in the pocket universe operates at a different speed to our universe. And I think the doctor says that 3 minutes in the pocket universe equates to several hundred thousand years in our universe. And yet when he goes in there and he rescues Hiller, where I mean, after rewatching it, I guess they're there for not more than about 3 minutes, but it feels like he's there for a whole lot longer, and yet time in our universe doesn't really change at all.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the
lesson.
Yes, I think there's something about the narrative. Do you know what I mean? That once we have the Doctor there, while all of our other characters are somewhere else, we can't do that anymore. And he will actually, and Moffat will successfully do something similar in World Enough and Time, where he has one character experiencing time at a different rate from everyone else, in a way that just about works. But I sort of understood that her whole experience was like 3 minutes, but she seems to have been there at the beginning. Oh, I guess that's, you know.
Because otherwise at the end she'd be like, oh, it's no big deal. I was only there for 2 minutes. I mean, thanks for rescuing me.
But yeah,
honestly, I've spent longer in a lift, you know. Quite pinned down what her experience was.
In the loop.
Yeah. And there's a lot of realization moments. Of course, I've been such a fool. It's obviously not, the monster's not trying to eat everybody. It's just in love, because that's the theme of this episode. And the doctor just realizes that, doesn't he? Which, again, that's what happens in this show a lot, but it's always a bit risky when you try to just carry it in that
because
way.
There or have is I missed no an evidence?
Why is that there, though? Why is it there?
It's really odd, isn't it? Because we don't resolve it either. Like, it's kind of like that new plot thing gets introduced right at the end after everything else is resolved, and then it doesn't get resolved itself. We just stop midway through. And I liked that ending. I think more Doctor Who should end like that. I don't think it should be, you know, the usual thing where we don't say goodbye and the TARDIS disappears or whatever. I quite like it finishing in the middle of the action. It's a bit like a bit like the end of Pirate Planet episode 4.
Well, that'd be like Earthshock as well. Yes. Beryl Reed's floating around in an escape pod. And it's just like, we'll get back to it. Yeah.
I guess I'm just cold of heart, because I just don't know why it's there, and it undermines the rest of the episode, really. And it just reminded me of Time Heist, of course, which is to come. I'm surprised it didn't cut to an image of the monsters walking off into the distance holding claws or whatever it is they'd hold.
Well, they only made one, I think would be the answer to that.
Well, yeah, and so, and I mean, I've probably whined before about romance being the last thing I want in Doctor Who because it's everywhere and it's not, and so the reason one of the things I like about this story is it does stuff that normally annoys me, but it doesn't annoy me as much as it normally does because of a lot of the other stuff that it's coming in with. It does carry it in a way that it sometimes doesn't. And I keep going back to remembering at this point, the Doctor's awareness of the sexiness of Clara is just something that's handled, I mean, very differently to the same thing with Amy, but it's always skirting a difficult area. And the idea that Emma is almost inevitably in love with the professor who she looks up to, it's a bit of an assistant will always, so Sherlock is going on at the same time as this, obviously. And I'm already annoyed at this point by the way Sherlock's got the simpering woman who's in love with him, in the same way that we'll later get Osgood, who's in love and all klutzy around the Doctor. And that's a real motif of these two shows that was getting on my nerves at this point. Sorry, and I started out, this was me listing things I like about this story, and now I've gone off on one, which it's not, and it's not a main line of it. It is a thread through it. Yeah.
I actually like the way that romance is resolved, because there is all this kind of slightly irritating will they, won't they about it. And then the Doctor just comes in and says, oh, here's Hilla. She's your great, 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 great grandchild. So that's go. Both of you, right? So yeah. Go off and make and her, you know.
Yeah, and he lands the joke. That's the thing. That's one of those things that's on a knife edge. Matt Smith's, but you already knew that. Oh, you didn't. That little moment really works and does it very nicely, which if that had just not been quite like that, it could have been a big old clunk, I think.
Yeah, but, that's his Doctor in a nutshell, isn't it? That's the kind of thing he does and does brilliantly.
I'm getting a real sense that Matt's performance is starting to run out at this point. And there's lot of stuff that I still like a lot of stuff. I love his stupid reaction with his hands, you know, where Clara says, you don't need to hold my hand. And then he kind of looks at his hands and then goes, I'm not holding your hand. And then he kind of waves them about and stuff. And like, I think that's really funny. I think there's still some really funny physical awkwardness, but he's not surprising me with what he's doing quite so much anymore. And
yeah,
it is that thing where they start to write crazy Matt Smith things for Matt Smith to do instead of writing things and then letting Matt Smith do Matt Smith things with them. And I'm also just getting a kind of Pertwee in series 11 kind of feel, where all his playmates are gone and now he's just kind of waiting for the 50th to happen.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think this is where we get those criticisms of Matt coming in, where it's that he's just doing it by the numbers. He's a quirky Doctor. He's being written as quirky and he does his stick. So he does the spinning around on the spot. He does the hands waving all over the place. He does the, I'm a bit weird and this is all a bit strange and kooky when he's on the mysterious other time. All of those things we've seen him do better before. It's like he's not quite engaged with the material here. And I do wonder whether he's uneasy because this is the first one without Matt and Karen. Other than the Christmas specials, he's got a new companion in. Maybe he doesn't know what the dynamic is going to be and if they're going to work together well. And I think there's a feeling of trepidation in a lot of the scenes with the Doctor and Clara where neither of the two of them quite know how to play with each other, if you see what I mean, and how the scenes are going to go and how to do this yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the journey of the 11th Doctor is so closely linked to that of the Ponds, or more specifically Amy, that when Amy and Rory leave, I think his emotional arc is done. I mean, the 11th Doctor is done. He is ready. And I totally agree with you, Nathan. It feels like 7A is Pertwee's season 10 and 7B is season 11 for sure.
it's almost as if he's trying to create an imaginative backstory for Clara, because all there is she's someone he met, you know. Whereas he was his previous companion's imaginary childhood friend, and he just doesn't have that role. And later on it'll get bigger and whatever, and then we'll forget it and do something else. But there is something a little bit sort of clutching at straws that he's doing that is reflected in where we are with the show right now, I think.
Yeah. And yet you're absolutely right, Nathan. There are moments of brilliance. The moment I'd sort of noted down was you were the only mystery worth solving. And he plays it with such almost sadness. But also, is it that Clara is the mystery worth solving, or is it the human race is the mystery worth solving? And you don't know. But he plays that sort of nicely, enigmatically.
Yeah, it's clear that Clara takes it one way and that we as the audience take it a different way. And it is the 11th Doctor lying to his companions about why they're there. You know, Amy's there in series 5 because of the crack in her wall. In series 6, he doesn't tell her that she's pregnant. He doesn't say why he went to the Ganger's factory, that weird factory in the monastery. He's going there to find out about Ganger's because he already knows Amy is one. And then here, you know, he's come to see Emma, not the haunted house, because he wants to know who Clara is. And that consistent thing about Matt is where he seems really jolly and lovely, but he's actually a bit of a liar and a bit manipulative in a way that isn't reflected in his performance particularly. He never seems that he's being devious. I kind of like that. And I have a thing where I want my doctors to be a bit unlikable. And Matt just gets there, I think.
But he also does the alien doctor really brilliantly. He still manages to really capture that quality of the 11th Doctor. I mean, when Emma says, will it hurt? And he says, no, yes, probably a bit, well, quite a lot, etc. You know, I just think that's great, the way he plays that.
So he doesn't overdo it.
You're right. In amongst the Matt silliness, there are still those sort of essential 11th Doctor qualities there, which is great to see.
I guess because there's no villain, he doesn't get to do angry, and Matt angry is my absolutely favourite thing, because you never know how he's going to do it, and sometimes he does it just remarkably well. But this is an episode with no villain and turns out no threat. That's good, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is that good? I think that's probably good.
It's different.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, we don't want it to be that predictable. Yeah, yeah.
It's nice for a change.
I guess so.
Yeah. But yeah, and if there was just an old witch lady living in a house next door,
that was just elevated for you, Pete.
Then we're
it?
In the yeah, then would be top tier. What do we think about Clara's relationship with the TARDIS, which obviously is going to be explored a lot more next week? But this one, that the thing with the TARDIS suddenly talking to her, I was a little bit. In fact, I remember the roller coaster. I was like, "That, why has that suddenly come from? How can a companion bang on the TARDIS door and then the TARDIS suddenly starts talking to them after all these years? I hate that." And then 2 seconds later, she's in the TARDIS and flying, and the way that it's shot with her just clinging on to a thing and it's all, everything's just spinning around. I was like, okay, no, I like this now. That's a nice way of doing that.
So we have had the TARDIS's voice interface before in Let's Kill Hitler, and it appears as little Caitlin Blackwood, like after trying a few other recent new series companions on.
Yes, so of course. I'd forgotten that.
We have had that before. And there is that thing, there is something about Clara's character where the person that she loves and trusts is her, and that's like a dig at her. And it turns out that's kind of where we end up going with the character, I think. So that actually works quite well.
Yes, it does. Somehow I've forgotten that part of Let's Kill Hitler completely. Okay, yeah.
I do like, let me in, you grumpy old cow.
Yes.
That's a thing that we've had before too, isn't it? The TARDIS kind of got stressed about Jack because Jack had been sort of rendered a fixed point in time or something by Rose at the end of series 1. And so obviously the TARDIS can sense what's going to happen to Clara in the finale of this season, I guess.
And yeah, because she's not a normal person, is she? I mean, she's sort of
now, but she won't be later. And I mean, that's actually the, you know, what I think is the best, most satisfying arc in new series Doctor Who is series 3, and it is just because John Sim gets in the TARDIS in episode 11 and then travels back in time to the end of series 2 and then starts appearing in all of the episodes sort of. And I think that's really great. It's a low-hanging fruit when you've got a time machine in the show. You can do that sort of quite easily, and I think that works really well. So I kind of don't mind this. I like the idea that even though we are given the answer to the mystery by Emma, there is still something going on that we aren't aware of. And, of course, we've seen Asylum of the Daleks and the Snowmen as well.
So, can we talk about Village of the Angels? And you might wonder about this, but we've got a November setting in a spooky kind of haunted house where they're doing experiments into the unknown. We've got a war hero who's a bit lost and hasn't found his place in the world. We've got using someone's odd psychic powers to do these experiments, and a village on the edge of the world.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That cliff thing that surrounds the pocket universe is also in Village of the Angels.
Oh, you're talking a Chibnall story, aren't you? That's right.
I am, yeah. It's a complete remix of this adventure that I hadn't noticed until I watched Hyde again.
I think Angels does it better, but because it's got a threat.
I think it probably does, actually.
Because it's got more of a threat. The threat is real.
Yeah.
Other than, I mean, the biggest threat in this ultimately is that the Doctor might go on to sing the racist verses of Let's Do It, which fortunately he doesn't do. We just get the nice jolly one before he starts listing all the ethnicities of the world and the different ways in which they do it, which is not Cole Porter's finest hour.
Yeah. No, we just get as far as Fleas, and I think it's the time to stop right there. Yeah, I mean, I think Village of the Angels is a problem because it doesn't end up being a story because it has that cliffhanger and then sort of never comes back from it. And so it's not a story that has any kind of resolution. I think within Flux, it's one of the two strongest episodes, I think. But I guess once we've done Hyde, there's nothing particularly surprising in Village of the Angels, although it does get some points for having the psychometrograph thing draw an angel. I thought that was pretty great.
Squiggly lines, basically. Little things doing squiggly lines in the past. And it's showing it in this, it's the heritage of the stone tape and the potential Quatermass crossover, which was in early drafts before copyright issues were pointed out, I think.
Yeah, and Nigel Neal famously hated Doctor Who, so there's no way his estate would ever give them the character of Quatermass, wouldn't they? So.
Doctor Who, what's his quote? Doctor Who's about frightening children. He wants to unsettle adults, I think is the quote.
Yeah, I think, like, Sandifer has this thing about how basically Quatermass is a bit reactionary, you know, that it's sort of foreigners and young people and stuff are where the threat is located. And Doctor Who is the opposite of that. And so perhaps it's just as well that Professor Quatermass isn't in this one. Imagine him discovering that there's no threat. There's no threat, nothing to see here.
In our headcanons, where do the monsters that aren't really monsters end up? Because, if this was Quatermass, it would turn out that they were actually infesting humanity since the dawn of time and we'd all explode or something.
I think the Doctor takes them to the planet of Kolkakron again.
Everyone's there. Everyone's there.
There's a big party going on.
And the Grand Serpent's on Kolkakron Heights.
Absolutely.
not many people know that.
If it was the Stone Tape, then that means Jessica Raine is playing Jane Asher's character from the Stone Tape. And Jane Asher, of course, is a canonical Susan Foreman from the BBC's Whatever Happened to Susan Foreman. So there's a link there to I like the idea of the actress who played Verity Lambert playing a character who's inspired by a character who was played by an actress. I'm sorry, I've lost. Yeah, there's something there. Right? I just love that.
She's Sarah Jane's replacement in Whatever Happened to Sarah
Jane. She is fabulous as well. Yeah. It's basically an infinite universe.
She's fantastic
of Jane
in that.
She is such a good actress. Yeah. And cake decorator too, which, I mean, what more could you want?
Listener, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week to learn a valuable moral lesson about not convincing your little brother he's a robot or something in Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger, Jodie into Terror, Maximum Power, and Untitled Star Trek Project. Corey, where can people find you?
I don't have a Twitter account. I must be the only one here who doesn't have one, but you can find me on Instagram at McMahonCorey.
And Pete, where can people find you?
I'm currently Severity Lambert, which has suddenly become my... how was that available? Nobody... That's the ultimate drag name on Twitter. I have a habit of popping up on podcasts, I'm afraid, which will very soon be the new series of Maximum Power, a Blake 7 podcast of which you may have heard.
And Cy, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Cy_Hart. And you can also hear me on the new series of Maximum Power and many other Doctor Who podcasts.
Until next time, remember that I'm still a grown-up and there's actually no need to keep holding my hand. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Cy Hart, Pete Lambert and Corey McMahon. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Ghost Reasons, was recorded on the 12th of June 2022 and released on the 25th of September. Most people don't know this, but many of Terry Nation's scripts also had romantic endings that were changed in editing. Imagine if we'd seen Android Sarah and Android Harry plugging in together, Batan and Severin walking off hand in hand into a radioactive sunset, or Susan staying behind on Earth with someone she actually had sexual chemistry with.
That could be an out. That could kill the podcast.
Ultimate incoherent ramble.
It could break any podcast.
That thing in that Sarah Jane in the Sarah Jane Adventures thing, and she's a villain because she's replaced Sarah Jane, and you know she's made a choice, and the choice is for her to live and Sarah Jane to die, and so she's bad. But there's that moment where she just says, "It's my birthday," and I just die. It's so heartbreaking. She's so good.
And Sarah says, "When Sarah says you weren't meant to live," and she's like, "What do you mean I wasn't meant to live?" It's like that's
yeah. It's all of that time bullshit too, which I really hate. You know, that we have a moral responsibility to ensure that time goes the way that it goes. It's just like the most miserable centrist bullshit, you know, like
not the status quo.
yeah, that's it. Oh dear. It's the one thing about Rosa that I don't like is that is that the doctor doesn't plant a bomb in the Alabama State House and then just give the governor one chance and then he says no and then he gets the shit blown out of him. That would improve that episode.
Yeah, cool. Could at least do a happiness patrol and murder his pet. That would be the next best thing.
yeah. He gets to find his dog. Oh, no, we can't do that. I'm still upset about Mark of the Rani and obviously 7 billion dogs at the end of Flux.